This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, June 1st. I'm Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, we'll get an update on what's new at Boulder City Hall with reporter Shea Castle of Boulder Beat News. The Biden administration's recent economic stimulus package included $5 billion for black farmers to help address decades of discrimination that drove many growers out of business. We'll visit with two black farmers here in Boulder County. At the bottom of the hour, we'll play our weekly comment line, comments from listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU. At 8:30, it's How on Earth. In today's science show, we'll hear about new solar tech and old water issues here in Boulder. At 9 a.m., it's The Wit and Wisdom of Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, The Morning Sound Alternative, 2.5 hours of eclectic music until noon. But first, it's time for local and regional headlines. In COVID news, an order issued by the Colorado State Health Department Monday says those planning large indoor events with more than 500 people no longer need the state's approval. The amended order from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment goes into effect today as transmission of COVID-19 and hospitalizations due to the disease level off. The order is scheduled to expire July 1st. The health department order still encourages individuals to remain at least 6 feet away from non-household contacts, wash their hands, and wear a face covering to reduce the likelihood of disease transmission. The order also requires masks for people who are not fully vaccinated in jails, prisons, K-12 schools, childcare facilities, camps, and medical facilities. Colorado lawmakers are considering a bill that would change the way annual state park passes are distributed. Legislation proposed would add a fee to a vehicle's yearly registration. The driver could then pay for the pass, called the Keep Colorado Wild Annual Pass, along with their registration, instead of having to go directly through Colorado Parks and Wildlife. The bipartisan bill co-sponsors say the state experienced a significant increase in the number of visitors at state parks last year, and it's been a challenge for Parks and Wildlife to keep up with the number of people visiting Colorado's 42 state parks. A similar system in Montana has brought the annual state park pass fees down to $9 annually. Our soggy Memorial Day weekend does not predict what might be ahead in July and August for hot weather on the Front Range. A weekend story by the Associated Press says more than one-third of the world's heat deaths each year are due directly to climate change. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
The Associated Press, reporting from a recent research, that was the first study to detail climate change-related heat deaths now rather than in the future. Scientists took observed temperatures and compared them with 10 computer models simulating a world without human-caused climate change. By applying to the individualized heat death curves from 732 cities, the scientists then calculated in the extra heat deaths from climate change. Dr. Jonathan Patz, director of the Global Health Institute at the University of Wisconsin, said that this credited study directly answers the question of people asking for proof that man-made climate change is affecting people globally. The journal Nature Climate Change said that researchers looked at heat deaths in 732 cities around the globe from 1991 to 2018. They calculated that 37% of the deaths, about 9,700 people a year, from just those cities were caused by higher temperatures from human-caused warming. The highest percentages of heat deaths caused by climate change were in cities in South America. São Paulo, Brazil, averaged 239 deaths a year. New York City topped U.S. cities with 141 heat-caused deaths per year. The researchers said that some cities adapt to heat better than others because of air conditioning, cultural factors, and environmental conditions. Some scientists say that heat deaths are only a small fraction of the climate's overall toll, as even more people die from extreme weather such as storms, flooding, and drought. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
The exceptionally rainy month of May is behind us, but we could see more today. The National Weather Service tweeted that Denver got nearly 4 inches of rainfall last month. And as unlikely as it may seem, that's more than Seattle and Portland combined. This is one of the top 20 wettest Mays on record for the Denver-Boulder area, but it's a different story on the western slope, where conditions remain abnormally dry, creating concerns after the 2020 wildfire season. Above 9,500 feet over the weekend, snow was reported, and after opening for the season on Friday, Trail Ridge Road had to be closed due to snow. A high of 67 is predicted for today and sunny skies for the rest of the week. 75 degrees tomorrow and around 85 by the weekend. Right now outside our Boulder studios, it's 48 degrees. You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Following yesterday's holiday, Tuesday is the first day of the work week, and that means there's a Boulder City Council meeting. KGNU's Roz Brown talks to Shay Castle, a journalist and owner and publisher of Boulder Beat News, about what's on tonight's agenda.
Good morning, Shay. It's the day after Memorial Day, and we have a City Council meeting tonight, and I know they have the budget on the agenda. There's a Settlers Park. There's a couple other things. So can you kind of just frame for us what is on the agenda that people might want to be watching for?
Absolutely. It's a bit of an odd agenda. There are two public hearings on allowing lightweight vehicles at the Boulder Airport and allowing the sale of hemp at marijuana businesses. Those are the two opportunities for public input. Not very broad-ranging interest to the community. I think if you're in those businesses or, you know, a user of the airport, you might care. But, you know, even the airport, which sometimes gets some interest because of noise, lightweight vehicles are the least noisy vehicles that they would have. So I don't know how interested the general public might be in that. But to me, I'm looking at the city is finally, after 5 years, petitioning to rename Settlers Park, which is something that they pursued as part of Indigenous Peoples Day. The resolution they passed in 2016 called for, you know, more recognition of the history of Indigenous peoples in this area, which was colonized by European settlers. And as part of that, they had a goal to rename Settlers Park, and they finally come up with a name in consultation with area tribes. And so that will be before council. Basically, if council doesn't call it up, that's what they call when they review a decision, the name will be changed by Indigenous Peoples Day of this year, which is in October. So that's an exciting thing to see.
Right. And they put out a press release last week talking about that. And it looks like it's clearly a nod toward DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But also they have said just trying to get over these names that suggest that there only have been white folks who settled this land. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. There were lots of peoples here before European settlers arrived in 1858 to mine for gold. And the particular area, soon to be formally known as Settlers Park, going to be known as the People's Crossing, is said to be the place where European settlers first arrived and the place where Arapaho Chief Niwot told them, like, hey, you can't be here. This is our land. And there's a treaty that says you can't be here. And of course, you know, the miners stayed and Indigenous peoples were pushed out. And that's how Boulder, as we know it today, came to be. So it's really kind of acknowledging that history. You know, there were people here living and this was their land before it was European land. And, you know, they're working with representatives of more than a dozen tribes who had historic presence here to kind of make those repairs or at least acknowledgement.
And Shay, they're also going to talk about the city attorney. We have a new police chief, relatively new police chief, very new city manager, and now we're about to have a new city attorney.
Yes, city manager Jane Brodigam and city attorney Tom Carr both announced their retirements in 2020. Tom is retiring at the end of June. They were supposed to announce the finalists that they are recommending at the June 1st meeting, but they need more time. The search committee needs more time to name those finalists. But sometime in June, I believe, we're going to have the couple finalists named, and then it'll follow the same process as the city manager replacement did. There'll be public Q&A sessions with the finalists. There'll be a recommendation made on, you know, who the ultimate hire should be, and then city council will vote on that.
Well, looking ahead, Shay, we won't talk to you before then, so they have a study session the next week. What's on that agenda?
It's a very interesting study session. We're going to get an update on our partnership with Xcel Energy. We know when our bid for municipalization ended or, you know, was paused, there's a lot of work that Xcel and the city pledged to do together on helping us meet our goal of 100% renewable energy by 2030. So we're going to get an update on how that work is going. We're also doing a larger look at our climate action plan, which is how we're going to get to that goal and our other climate goals. And that by this point is a few years old. So we're looking at an update of that, updated actions, updated spending, updated things we might need to do to reach those goals. So that will obviously be, those are two items of very high interest in the community. And again, that's just a study session, so there won't be opportunity for public input, but there will be a lot of really good information, I expect, coming out of that meeting.
And remind us, Shay, they have talked about going back to city council chambers, hosting their meetings there in the future, inviting the public back in. What's the situation with that?
City Council itself intends to return in person July 13th. That is only going to be for members of City Council and some key staff. Most staff and all of the public who hope to participate will still be online, will still be virtual through the live stream or through the Zoom meeting. They haven't set a date yet for when the public will return. The city itself, the organization, will be fully operational in person September 7th is the goal now. So the public might return at that time. It might be a little later, but they felt that was the best way to keep everyone safe, but kind of get back to those in-person meetings that all the city council members seem to be really missing.
Well, thanks so much, Shay. We'll talk to you again in a couple weeks.
Looking forward to it.
That was journalist Shay Castle speaking with KGNU's Roz Brown. You can read more of Castle's work at boulderbeat.news. The Biden administration's recent economic stimulus package included $5 billion for black farmers to help address decades of discrimination that drove many growers out of business. Of the 3.5 million farmers in the U.S., only 1% are black. University of Colorado student Danny McLean visited some black farmers on the Front Range to talk about their experiences and about how to establish a more equitable and representative food system.
These outer beds that I have are more dedicated to all of my root crops right now. So radishes, beets, anything else that you could probably think of that's like a root, kohlrabi.
On a mild, sunny morning in March, Malik Salisbury gave me a tour of his farming operation in Golden, Colorado.
I am working in a 20 by 24 greenhouse dome growing a variety of crops through the winter here, utilizing passive solar heat.
The greenhouse, built by the nonprofit Growing Spaces, has allowed this young entrepreneur to kickstart his own farming business. Its name?
At Afro Ridge Farms. Well, radio can't see, but I have a very large afro, it just fit. I feel like it's very important to make your farm as recognizable and unique as possible. This is a pretty unique and obvious identifier for me.
Of the roughly 3.5 million farmers in the nation, over 90% are white and only about 1% are black. And Malik, just 25 years old, is part of that 1%.
It's also interesting, you know, when I go to conferences or when I go to panels and you know, you look into the crowd and it's white old men.
Farming wasn't always this way. At the start of the 20th century, about 14% of farmers were black. But black farmers have been systematically driven from their land by white people.
The loss in black farmland has been in the millions of acres over the last 100 years, whether that's through families selling off the land or having, you know, loan companies or the banks come and reclaim land, or, you know, recorded instances of the Ku Klux Klan showing up and running people off of their land.
From exclusion to workers' protections to discriminatory farm loan practices in the U.S. Department of Agriculture and more, black Americans are estimated to have lost about 13 million acres since the early 1900s. For Malik, Afro Ridge Farms is not just a name. It's a form of reclaiming this legacy.
So I think it's really important to kind of acknowledge, pay homage to my Black roots, especially since, you know, the struggle with Black farmers continues today, Black and brown farmers.
About 20 miles north of Malik's greenhouse in Golden, Frank Hodge owns and operates Father Earth Organic Farm in Lafayette. While Malik is just getting started in his farming career, Frank's been at it for a while. He got into farming as a kid in Massachusetts in the late 1950s, right in the middle of the civil rights movement.
Age 6, 7, 8, 10, even 15, 16, you couldn't get a job anywhere anyways, being a person of color in that area in Massachusetts. And so we were fortunate to be able to be on a farm, have some freedom to run around, freedom to learn about growing.
Ever since working with his dad on that farm, growing food has been an important part of Frank's life.
Every place I lived, I always had some sort of garden, or even in pots if I need to, or in my basement, doing hydroponics someplace, or whatever.
Plants, in Frank's words, are not discriminatory, unlike the reality he faced growing up.
You know, when I went to engineering school, one professor told me, he says, you'll never make it as an engineer. And I said, why is that? Because you're Black. So I said, yeah, okay, that's fine, whatever.
Undeterred, Frank built a family and his career. Through decades spent serving in the Air Force, working as an electronic technician at CU Boulder, and more, Frank continued growing food. Then, about 20 years ago, he came across an old horse pasture.
When I came here, I saw the potential, and I thought, well, I'm going to try this first, this little plot, and then from there, I grew and to where I am now.
Father Earth was born. Though Frank recognizes that he is one of very few Black farmers in Colorado, he says that the community and other farmers have been nothing but supportive. And Frank pointed out that another group has been historically underrepresented in farming, women.
A lot of women who were daughters of farmers never had the chance to farm. And in the past 3 or 4 decades probably, I would say that has changed quite a bit, because there are tons of females running farms now.
One of those women in farming is Fatima Imad.
I think that I get the most excited when I see my seeds popping up from the ground, and people are always like, well, you knew that would happen, Fatima. And I'm like, I really don't.
Being both a woman and a person of color, Fatima plays a crucial and inspiring role in the local Front Range food system. Fatima is the co-founder, head farmer, and executive director of Frontline Farming in Denver. Frontline Farming is a Black, Indigenous, people of color, and Women X-led farmer advocacy and food justice organization.
Coming from an immigrant, my family myself, and being Black and brown woman, for me, the work is to be able to bridge the stories of us gaining access to becoming farmers ourselves.
A lot of Fatima's work is at the policy level, advocating for a more equitable food system. But for her, the work goes beyond policy and growing food. It also requires reframing the stories we tell about farming.
It's a way of being able to tell our stories that don't only try to give it this Western European narrative of us being just enslaved people that came here, but rather the fact that we built the basis of the economy and that our foods are actually incorporated in all of the American narrative. It's just how history is told.
Fatima loves when women, people of color, and other underrepresented people step into farming themselves, paving the way for the next generation of young farmers, like Malik at Afro Ridge Farms.
For me, the work is to be able to bridge the stories of us gaining access to becoming farmers ourselves, and to make sure that those who want to do this work can be lifted up on our shoulders and not have to experience the same barriers that we do, and to create paths for our own communities in that way.
As for Malik?
I'd say, like, my big thing about hope is that, like, we're out there. Like, it's a small number of us, but, like, we're out there.
As for Malik, he feels hopeful about the future of young people, particularly people of color and women, in farming.
You know, especially being, you know, a Black man in an industry that's mostly ran by, you know, older white men, that's been ingrained in American culture as this promptly male, promptly white job. And it doesn't have to be either of those.
In the end, creating a more equitable, representative food system for all people is not just about reclaiming land, it's also about reclaiming a narrative.
That story was produced by CU Environmental Studies student Danny McLean as part of The Brink, a radio storytelling project. For more information on the farmers you heard in this piece, go to kgnu.org and click on news. Next up, we take a quick look at what's coming up on this evening's edition of Hemispheres. Host Elena Claver speaks with Edna Sandoval, a cross-border organizer with the Network in Solidarity with the People of Guatemala.
Right. The Xinka community, it's one of the most prominent groups, and I would say one of the most resilient groups in Guatemala. It's a group of indigenous communities that have been historically affected by state violence, first colonization, right? Then state violence with the civil war that targeted indigenous community and resulted in the genocide of the Ixchel people during the 80s and beginnings of the 90s. And after the war, we have a lot of displacement, product of the violence of the war, but also a lot of displacement that come in place because neoliberalism was passed in Guatemala in the 2000s, and the Xinka community had been historically targeted by the state violence, first during the war, and then with the introduction of neoliberal policies. But at the same time, I want to mention that the Xinka people is one of the groups that have been actively resisting and organizing against state violence and economic violence, capitalism, imperialism over the time. And in one of the many efforts of the local state, but complicit with the U.S., there's many, many legal process that have even argued that the Xinka people is not there anymore. Can you believe that? There's an ontological desire of get rid of the resistance at large, right, in the local imaginary, but also materially, because they are subject to many, many forms of violence.
That's this evening on Hemispheres at 6 p.m. And now we check in with KGNU's comment line when we hear what's on the minds of listeners.
Hi, my name is Ren. I just wanted to call and, first of all, just thank KGNU for all the great service that they've provided now and throughout the entire pandemic. It's been really greatly appreciated. And in addition, I would like to just remind everybody that as things are starting to open back up, to be extremely polite and kind to your service workers that have been working and grueling over providing these services for everybody for over a year now. So just a reminder to be friendly, be nice, be polite, be respectful, and don't be a d-. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Who's ever the host on Boulder's Today's Reggae Bloodlines? He's playing disco music. He's not playing reggae. Sucks. I'm turning it off.
This is Joan in Boulder. I want to commend Joel Edelstein for his commentary program last Friday. He had a very difficult topic that he introduced, and that was coming up with a solution for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And he invited community locals, not experts, but anyone who had some hopefully positive suggestions to call in. And first he gave a brief history of Israeli-Palestinian relations since 1947, which is very hard to do in 5 minutes. But what amazed me was that the people who called, there were about 6 callers, all male, which I found interesting, and all very rational. Nobody was excited or prejudicial in their views. They all felt that Israel should not be bombing Gaza, and that the United States should use its influence to get to a diplomatic solution to the problems in that part of the world. And I was just very impressed with the caliber of callers. And I thank Joel for bringing up a difficult topic. I was a little apprehensive about who would call, but it didn't happen. Anyway, thank you, Joel.
A reminder that if you'd like to share a comment with KGNU, call us at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25 during the Morning Magazine.
With the new KGNU Community Radio app, you have access to your favorite programs anywhere, anytime. Download the KGNU Community Radio app for free on iOS and Android and start streaming today.
Thanks for tuning in to the Morning Magazine today on KGNU. I've been your host, Shannon Young.